The crew of the shuttle Columbia reported problems on board as they prepared to land this morning. The crew reported trouble with sensors that recorded tire pressure and other information. Shortly after 8 o'clock Central Time, Mission Control in Houston asked the crew for an update, and their response ended in mid-sentence.
Columbia, Houston, we see your tire pressure messages, and we did not copy your last.
Roger.
And that was the final transmission as the shuttle flew over the state of Texas at 18 times the speed of sound. Across the Gulf of Mexico at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida, NASA Administrator Sean O'Keefe waited with families of the astronauts.
He's here this morning with the families of the astronauts and their friends. It started out as a pretty happy morning, awaiting the landing of STS-107. And we had highly anticipated their return because we couldn't wait to congratulate them for their extraordinary performance and their excellent efforts on the science mission on this very important flight. They dedicated their lives to pushing the scientific challenges for all of us here on Earth.
Very briefly, here are the astronauts. Commander Rick Husband, an Air Force colonel from Amarillo, Texas. William McCool, the pilot, a Navy commander from Lubbock, Texas. The payload commander was Michael Anderson, the son of an Air Force man, we're told, who grew up on military bases around the country. Kalpana Chawla grew up in India. David Brown was a Navy captain who joined the Navy after a medical internship and went on to fly planes before he went into the shuttle. Laurel Clark was a Navy diving medical officer aboard submarines. Ilan Ramon was the first Israeli to fly in space. On the ground in Texas tonight, police have spread yellow tape around the pieces of the shuttle and the places where they fell to the ground. At the Johnson Space Center in Houston, a NASA official described the disaster today as the loss of 7 family members. NASA officials have put shuttle flights on hold. They say they have a few months before they'll need a shuttle to resupply astronauts on board the International Space Station. In this hour and throughout the evening, we'll bring you the details from Florida, Texas, and Washington. And we start with NPR's Joe Palca, who's following the initial investigation of the crash. Joe, what have you been able to learn today?
Well, NASA has just completed, I guess, a press conference where they described the events of that they're aware of right now. As you said, shortly before 8 o'clock this morning, after the that's 8 o'clock Central Time, after right. The space shuttle had begun its, fired its rockets and begun its descent out of orbit, some signals appeared at Mission Control in Houston indicating that some of the temperature sensors in the wheel well where the landing gear were stored suddenly seemed to be giving very strange reports, as if someone, they said, it's almost as if someone had cut the wire to them. Then they started seeing over the next few minutes other sensors that were going out, and there was a signal to the astronauts aboard the space shuttle that this was happening, and that was part of the acknowledgement. There's not much they could do about it because, remember, they're traveling at this point 18 times the speed of sound, and they're 200,000 feet up, but this information was relayed to them. And what particularly concerns the mission controllers now as they look back is that sensors go out all the time. This happens from time to time. But these sensors seem to be independent of each other. So if you see a cluster of sensors go out and it happens to go through a junction box on the way to the main computer, you say, okay, maybe there's something wrong at the junction. But in this case, there were a lot of independent signals, and they were all on the left side of the airplane, of the spacecraft. Now, the reason that's of interest is that during liftoff 16 days ago, as the shuttle was lifting off, a piece of foam insulation that connects the external fuel tank to the main shuttle broke off, and they could see it hit the left wing. They don't know whether they hit the front, they hit the back, they just don't know. But they could see it slide off and hit the wing someplace. And all these reports are coming from the left side. So at the moment, that's a beckoning place to look for further, information. But it may be unrelated, it may not.
A little early to jump to conclusions, but a place to go to.
Exactly.
Can you give me an idea of how the investigation of this differs from a plane crash, which is an event that many of us are far more familiar with?
Well, one of the things that's different just to begin with is that a plane doesn't have telemetry. It doesn't have signals constantly pouring from sensors all throughout this aircraft giving information, whereas the shuttle is designed, I mean, you know, there's not a temperature sensor in every single compartment along the ailerons on the wing, so they already have a lot more information. I should also say, Steve, that the time that this happened was the time of the greatest heat of reentry. I mean, the temperatures that the wings were sensing were close to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. And you know, there are these ceramic tiles that cover the space shuttle's wings that dissipate that heat. And so the fact that these were all coming from the wing area and that there's some problem there in the wing, you know, it begins to make you think, although we don't know for sure, that the tiles or something like that might be related. The mission coordinators are anxious to see the debris on the ground because that may provide some more information. But there's no black box. It's a different kind of investigation.
Joe, NPR's Pat Duggins has been following the story throughout the day from the Kennedy Space Center in Florida and also listening to your remarks. Joe, as you've been listening to officials give their initial information today, what have you been able to glean? What additional information have you learned?
Well, hello, Steve. All of these indications may be a cause and may be an effect. That's the big question right now. That's why they have to go out and start putting all of the pieces of the puzzle together, the telemetry that Joe was alluding to, and also the actual physical evidence that can indicate what was under stress during this particular time, what was burnt. Perhaps if the scenario that a tile was damaged, and again, this is purely speculation at this point, if that turns out to be the cause, was there a certain portion of the orbiter that was damaged? Was it an aileron, one of the wing flaps that enables the astronauts to control the spacecraft? Because remember, after they fire their main thrusters to come down, they have only one chance at a safe landing, and that's if they maintain complete control of the orbiter. Here at the Kennedy Space Center, it was very clear something went wrong because we didn't hear the sonic booms about 2 minutes prior to landing. And then as the countdown clock toward the landing ticked away, it ticked down to zero, then started ticking up from there. Clearly something wrong had happened.
Pat, you're down there at the Kennedy Space Center where technicians are stressing, rightly so, that it may be a while before they know exactly what happened. But do you get a sense that people are beginning to have some instinct on this, some sense of which way to go?
There are indications, but then again, you get into the problem of is it the cause or is it the effect? We were hearing speculation early on about the alarm that the astronauts heard in the wheel well of the spacecraft.
Yeah.
Was that the cause of the accident, or was it simply an effect, a cascading effect? As you heard, they started seeing problems about 7 minutes before the actual loss of signal from the spacecraft. So a number of things obviously going on at this point. They have to look at all the evidence, put it all together. It could be something obvious, such as the tile damage. It could be something else. We'll just have to wait and see.
Pat Duggins in Florida, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Joe Palca, thank you very much. We'll come back to you throughout the evening and continue to get the latest information.
Sure.
Next, we want to bring you the voices of several eyewitnesses who spoke to NPR this morning. Some of them were watching for the shuttle this morning. Others simply woken by the sound.
I was standing outside when it came, and rather than hearing a distinct sonic boom, what I heard was like a loud, long rolling thunder type of noise, and in addition the contrail was very spread out going from the west to the east over the horizon. I knew something didn't look right.
It was just a gigantic double boom sound, like just boom, boom.
The noise, as I say, was very intense. It lasted probably about a minute and a half, and then it decreased as the plume headed directly straight in the southeast.
It rattled the building. It was loud, but far off, if you know what I mean. I was waiting to start hearing sirens or see smoke from my building or something.
In the south, across the sky, going from west to east, I saw it was a bright glow, and at first I thought it was a meteor or something like that. We see those quite often out here. Mm-hmm. It just flew right across the sky from horizon to horizon, just faster than you can imagine, and bright purple all the way.
Eyewitnesses to today's space shuttle disaster who called NPR this morning to report what they'd seen. We heard from Mike Buffington in Nacogdoches, Texas, Barbara Lancaster in Richardson, Texas, Bob Moulter of Palestine, Texas, Sheila McKay in Dallas, and Brian Patterson in Silver Springs, Nevada. Joining us now from member station WPSU in State College, Pennsylvania, is Jim Pawelczyk. He teaches at Penn State University, and in 1998, he was an astronaut aboard the shuttle Columbia. Mr. Pawelczyk, thanks for being with us.
Good afternoon. Thank you for inviting me here.
when you were on a mission, how often did you think about something like this?
Well, part of the training of becoming an astronaut is, of course, preparing for contingencies. About 80% of the training are for the off-nominal states that just don't fit into what the normal flight plan is. So although you may not be thinking of this particular scenario, you're always prepared for something that might occur.
Now, I know with a plane, pilots are warned that crashes most commonly happen during takeoff and landing. It's a time that requires extra concentration. Is that the same with the shuttle? As you were preparing to go in for that landing, were you especially on your toes?
Well, at that particular time in the flight, of course, you're already prepared for reentry. So everybody is back in those orange launch and entry suits that you see. They're strapped in their seats. It's a time when you're experiencing maximal aerodynamic pressure on the vehicle as it slows down coming through the atmosphere. It's, of course, then heating up very much, and it's a time when you're experiencing the highest G-forces during reentry, typically about 1.5 G.
Which means you are, how's that make you feel? I mean, what's the effect on you?
You're, of course, experiencing gravity for the first time on your body in a period of time. So you feel extremely heavy, and you're getting that extra half a G or so, which is squeezing you down in your seat even more so.
But you're still having to work, read instruments and so forth.
That's right. So up on the flight deck, there's still quite a bit of monitoring going on and checking on vehicle state.
Mr. Pawelczyk, I understand that you were friends with some of the Columbia crew.
Three of the members of this crew were part of the 96 astronaut class, which is about the time where we began training for our mission, which flew in 98. Some of them were certainly running partners and people that I knew and as professional friends, and just a great group of people all the way around.
You're out of the space program now, but did you talk to any of them before they went up on this mission?
I haven't seen him in a while. We bumped into each other at a few meetings along the way, and Laurel, she had just been assigned to this flight and was beginning to get ready. A lot of the experiments here are similar to the types of things that we flew, so we had a chance to exchange professional notes on how some things might be done, and of course, just always those catch-ups that you like to do with friends around the office.
Mr. Pawelczyk, we just have a few seconds left, but I'm wondering if before an astronaut goes on a mission like this, I mean, if preparations are made as a matter of course, preparations for this possibility.
Well, every astronaut when they prepare to launch has a person who is a family contact in the astronaut office. It's somebody who can just kind of keep all the friends and loved ones apprised of what's going on, and that is an important part of this. Of course, you've got your close friends and family in places where you want them so that they're safe and protected, and our thoughts certainly go out to the families today.
Mr. Pawelczyk, can you stay with us?
Sure.
Jim Pawelczyk is a former astronaut who teaches at Penn State, and he will be back with us then later in the hour. NPR's Wade Goodwin is on the road outside Palestine, Texas, which is where we'll go next. That's the middle of the debris field. Wade, I guess you've been seeing pieces of the debris as you've been driving along the roads in East Texas. Can you tell us what you've seen?
Yeah, I mean, it's the debris field extends from south of Dallas. It's a 60-mile-wide debris field, as far as authorities can tell, for hundreds of miles from northwest to southeast across the state. I got my first lesson in this when I was on my way to East Texas this morning. I was about 50 miles southeast of Dallas, still 100 miles away from where I thought I was going to find the debris field, and I saw a couple of police cars pulled over on the side of the highway. And I pulled off and came across the grass, and they had a volunteer fireman had found right next to a high school, probably 30 yards from the interstate, a piece of ceramic tile. It was badly burned, and it looks like it may have come from the undercarriage of the space shuttle. And within 5-10 minutes of arriving there, there was a small crowd gathered to take a look at what had been found.
Wade, in the few seconds we have left, tell us about this town, Palestine.
Palestine is a very small East Texas town, and literally hundreds of pieces have fallen all over the place, some as big as 4 feet long, and people are driving around trying to find the pieces. Authorities are scrambling to post as many people of authority as they can wherever the pieces are found to mark them off.
Okay, gotta cut you off, Wade. Wade, gotta cut you off. Thanks very much. You're listening to NPR News. From NPR News, this is special coverage of the Columbia disaster. I'm Steve Inskeep. Still no word precisely why the Space Shuttle Columbia broke apart this morning. 200,000 feet over Texas. Shuttle was just 16 minutes away from its scheduled landing at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida when ground controllers lost communication. That was about 8 o'clock in the morning, Central Time. Today, NASA officials expressed their grief and promised to find out what went wrong. And in a nationally broadcast address, President Bush said that whatever they find, the space program will not come to an end.
The cause in which they died will continue. Mankind is led into the darkness beyond our world by the inspiration of discovery and the longing to understand. Our journey into space will go on.
NASA officials and engineers are being careful not to speculate about what might have caused the catastrophic events that led to the loss, but aeronautical engineers are familiar with the kinds of dangers posed during the crucial moments when the shuttle re-enters the atmosphere and prepares to land. NPR's Christopher Joyce has talked to some of these experts and joins us now. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
The Columbia was re-entering the atmosphere when it apparently came apart. We're told just re-entering the atmosphere. What happens at that time, and what provides clues to you?
The sequence of events is roughly that the shuttle turns tail first and then fires its main thrusters to slow down. Then it turns back around again, front first, more like an airplane, a conventional airplane, and hits the upper atmosphere at about 17,000 miles per hour. And it starts to heat up, and it reaches something like 3,000 degrees. And the heat has always been one of the major obstacles for aerospace engineers. The shuttle is made of aluminum, and it can only handle a few hundred degrees of that, so you have these tiles to protect the shuttle from the heat. It's slightly nose up, so that the nose and especially the bottom of the fuselage is the most vulnerable. So if there are missing tiles, especially on the bottom and on the nose and on the leading edges of the wings, this is where you could get a catastrophic failure.
And what other vulnerabilities do you have to look out for?
Well, the pilot or the computers that are operating for much of the time or some of the time before the pilot takes over again have to maneuver the craft, and they do several things to navigate, but they also do some side-to-side dipping in order to slow down. And in order to do that, they use flaps. And there are flaps, I believe there's some under the wing. I know there's a big one underneath the fuselage. And it's very important for these to work properly because the shuttle has to come in at just the right angle. And there's a very narrow window. That angle has to be just right, not only for navigation, but, again, that has to present the most heat-resistant part first.
When you say side-to-side dipping, it's actually rocking a little bit from side to side?
Well, kind of a yawing, I think, might be the description. This slows it down. It's a mechanical way to slow down because they're not really using fuel at that point.
And these flaps are controlled how?
They're controlled by auxiliary power units. Basically, that's where the power comes from. It works through a hydraulic system. This is another part of the operation which is critical. I mean, they can't afford to have a failure. Now, there are three auxiliary power units, and they're run on hydrogen fuel. And there's redundancy built in there, as there are in so many of the critical parts of the shuttle. And so if one of them were to fail, presumably the other ones would pick up on this. But the hydraulics, of course, that control the actuators are vital because if the shuttle loses the proper attitude, it could possibly tumble. And that would, again, expose it to greater heat or in places where it can't take heat. And I want to add, very important here, that nobody is speculating that this has happened. And these are merely what engineers say, aeronautical engineers say, are the sort of vulnerable moments.
Chris, I was talking to somebody this morning, and she was saying as she was listening to the early radio coverage of this, not quite realizing what it was, she thought it was actually a replay of old footage from the Challenger crash in 1986. I'm sure there must be NASA engineers who are looking for parallels between that investigation and this one and trying to figure out what they can learn.
Most engineers who are familiar, and aeronautical engineers and aerospace engineers, do mention the history with the Challenger because, you know, this is an extremely, extremely complex vehicle. Engineers are constantly studying ways to predict failure in complex systems. And more than one has mentioned the fact that when it turned out was that what brought the Challenger down was not something that they'd really expected. It was a safety device, actually. It was this O-ring in that was built into the solid rocket boosters that was supposed to make them safer, and it was a real surprise for a lot of people. In fact, the way that it came out, I think the first time the commission studying the Challenger accident headed in that direction was a physicist on the commission had taken a piece of O-ring material and dropped it in his cup of ice and noticed that it hardened up. Said, you know, funny, these O-rings don't behave very well under cold weather, do they? And one thing led to the next, and that played a big role in leading to the actual conclusion of that investigation.
You always learn one more thing, I suppose. When was the last time that the Shuttle Columbia went through a major overhaul? Pretty old vehicle here.
It is the oldest. It was the first to fly, but it's had several. I think there was one in 91, and there was another retrofit in 94. And then there was another major retrofit in 1999 I think it was performed by Boeing under contract to another organization, but it was done in California. From what I've seen, there were a lot of changes made, but none that I've seen that would lead one, at least certainly not a professional, like myself, an unprofessional, to point a finger at anything in particular.
NPR's Chris Joyce. Chris, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And now former astronaut Jim Pawelczyk is back with us. Mr. Pawelczyk, I'd like to try to get a sense of what the preparation is like as a shuttle crew prepares to come back to Earth. Can you just describe what you're doing in that final day, that final few hours as you're getting ready to come back after a long mission?
Sure, Steve. It's actually a very, very busy day. The process of deorbit and reentry is really about a four-hour period overall. Preparing the vehicle and essentially reconfiguring it from a orbital system into something that will approximate a glider. The crew is busy getting themselves ready as well. They have to, of course, change out of the regular flight clothes that you see, changing into the launch and entry suits, those orange suits that you typically see. There's some major reconfiguration on the vehicle. You've heard mention earlier in the day about a escape pole, and that's put back into place near the hatch. Once everything is set, the seats are put back out and locked into place, then everybody is strapping in and getting set with their cooling. Of course, during this time, you're actually deorbiting the vehicle. Typically, you're only slowing it down by about 150 miles an hour or so to drop it out of orbit.
Wow.
Yeah. The contact with the atmosphere, of course, is graded, but we consider that to be somewhere over the area of Hawaii, and then gradually, as the air becomes denser and denser, and as you bleed off speed, you go into these S-turns that your previous speaker was just describing. I think you can imagine them quite similar to a person skiing downhill. You control your speed by kicking your skis out side to side and leaning, and that's essentially what the space shuttle is doing during this time. Trading off that energy means that you result in the buildup of heat. So you see during that time, actually the vehicle around you begin to glow in various parts, a plasma field develops, and you can see the plasma sort of building and collapsing, skipping along the top side of the vehicle. And then as you work through that time and reach the point where aerodynamic surfaces work again, it essentially becomes much more like a glider and comes in and then does its final turn and into final approach at Kennedy Space Center.
I was fascinated to hear that description because I was wondering, I realize you get massive, extensive training before you go up there, but I wonder if anything can really prepare you for that experience of hitting the atmosphere again and preparing to come back to Earth.
Well, that's certainly one part of the training that you can't simulate. But what you can do, of course, is go through all the processes that are involved with that. You always have the microgravity factor. That's something that you can only simulate in very, very short periods of time, and you really can't do with a time like deorbit and entry. But gravity is something, of course, that we're all familiar with. The surprise usually comes when things start to fall again instead of float, and you realize that you are back under the influence of the Earth's gravitational field.
I was also interested to read about the incredible variety of different experiments and studies that were being done on this mission, which I suppose must also have been the case when you went up in 1998. It almost seems like you're going up there, you're almost the drivers of a big moving van with a bunch of different packages for different places, and you're trying to find out what you can learn about different aspects of space.
Steve, that's a pretty reasonable analogy. These experiments, of course, have been developed over a period of years and usually carry a very large international flavor. Many of those experiments, of course, have transitioned to the International Space Station, but there are some that can still be done over short periods of time where the shuttle is the appropriate vehicle to use. This particular flight flew the Spacehab double module, which is a very nice scientific module that is carried in the shuttle's cargo bay. It basically size of maybe a 15-passenger van or so, slightly larger than that, that's full of science equipment. And yes, it is very much a moving van transporting these things back and forth.
Mr. Pawelczyk, in the few seconds we've got here, I don't want to make you speculate too much, but I'm wondering, as you have watched the news today, if anything has caught your eye or your ear as you wonder what happened.
Actually, I'm not choosing to speculate at this time. I think that's an inappropriate place to be placing our thoughts at this time. We need to let the experts at NASA do their work, and our thoughts should be with the families of these crew members.
I think that's fair enough. Mr. Pawelczyk, thanks very much. Really appreciate you taking the time.
You're welcome.
And we turn now to NPR's Tom Gelton. He covers national security and issues for NPR. Tom, one question that immediately leaped to everyone's mind, automatic question this morning, is there any possible link to terrorism here? Has that question been definitively answered at this point?
No, Steve, it can't be definitively answered, although, let's say, 90% of it has been answered. It's extremely unlikely that terrorism had anything to do with this, principally because the greatest threat of a terrorist attack on a shuttle mission has always been it being hit with, say, another aircraft or a missile. And the fact that this explosion happened at an altitude of over 200,000 miles means that it was really at 200,000 feet outside the range of any missile. Having said that, there were special security concerns around this mission right from the beginning for two reasons. One, we're in the midst of a global war on terrorism. There are groups out there that seem determined to go after U.S. interests, American facilities. I spoke to an intelligence official about this today, and the official said that security concerns around the shuttle missions are high these days for the simple reason that they are symbols of U.S. national power. Second, one of the crew members, as we've pointed out, was an Israeli fighter pilot who was in combat both during the 1973 Yom Kippur War and later, we heard, took part in the Israeli attack on the Iraqi nuclear reactor in 1981. So he was a symbol as well. So certainly this was a special mission in the context of security concerns.
What kind of precautions were taken both at the launch and in preparation for the landing?
Well, especially at the launch, the no-fly zone around the launch site was widened to 35 miles instead of the normal 5 miles, and it was imposed 3 hours earlier. So you had F-15 fighters as well as heavily armed helicopters flying around this launch area to make sure that within this 35-mile zone, wide zone, that nobody came in. They presumably could have shot down any intruding aircraft in that area. They had very sophisticated radar coverage of this zone, including the AWACS aircraft with their huge radar capability. Even surface-to-air missile batteries were activated around that launch area. As far as the landing is concerned, Today, there were fewer security precautions, mainly because this aircraft is much less vulnerable at landing than it is at launch. It comes in very steeply, very quickly, so the window, as it were, where it could be hit is much smaller. But there were still additional security precautions today at landing.
Would have been hard for an airplane or a missile even to catch up to this thing.
It sure would have. It would have had a very short time when it could have been hit.
Were any of these precautions taken because of specific intelligence information, or were these simply general precautions, as you said, because of the general threat of terrorism?
That's right, Steve. These were general precautions taken. I have been pressing on this all day. I have spoken to military officials and intelligence officials. They insist that there was no specific credible threat against this mission, or for that matter, against any previous shuttle mission. No specific intelligence that came across the transom that would suggest that this mission was under any particular threat.
Tom Gelton is NPR's national security correspondent. Tom, thanks very much.
Sure, Steve.